You're listening to Talking Hoosier Baseball,
a podcast by fans
from the iubase.com website.
For anyone wanting more information on the Indiana University baseball program.
Welcome to this very special preseason preview discussion. We're recording this on Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. I'm Cassie Palmer, joined by Master of the RPI, Carl James, the creator of iubase.com, Josh Bennett, and the man feverishly retweeting advanced statistics on IU commits, Chris Feeney. Our guest tonight is IU head baseball coach, Jeff Mercer. Welcome, coach.
Hi.
All right, so I'll get us started on the questions tonight, Coach. So how are you feeling about your team's hitting approach heading into the start of play? Are they ready to go right now?
As we sit currently, no. Came out of Christmas break doing fine. The last 2 weeks, we haven't been great. Kind of went back in the last couple of days and kind of got back after some of the drill work. But the last couple of days have been some good work days, and we'll get back after it. But I do like the group overall.
Which newcomers are we likely to hear about the first few weeks of the season?
I would say Paul Tate. You know, Paul was here last year, but redshirted, had an injury. Paul got a chance to be a really, really fine player. Jacob Southern is another new guy from an offensive standpoint that I think has a chance to impact the lineup and be a good player. Kip Fugers is another one that I think is going to have a chance to help, and it is a really good player as well. So there's a couple of new guys there that I think have a chance to help the club, and you can also add in there a couple of those outfielders potentially, Morgan Calipi and Bobby Whalen, and has that whole outfield situation kind of matriculates and works its way out. So several of those new guys I think have a chance to really help.
You mentioned Morgan Calipi, and I remember his name came up as far as MLB draft before he committed. And you got a couple of players on the roster now. Their names are coming up for draft discussion. How do you guys work with a player to handle the extra stress that's going to come with, you know, seeing your name up with names like that?
No, it's a great question. It's something that you handle a lot. I think the first thing that we have to help them understand is, I want you to play Major League Baseball. I want you to do those things. But if we don't play Major League Baseball, our entire life is not going to lack fulfillment. Like, we're not going to pin our entire hopes and dreams on only one ambition. So that if that one thing happens, I've made it. And if it doesn't, then everything else is a failure. I think we put too much stock in that. Now, I want those guys to do it. And I want those guys to go and play. But I think when we understand that I'm going to have a fulfilling life, I'm going to have a chance to impact people across the spectrum in my life in a really positive way, regardless of what happens with this, we can put a little bit in perspective. And the second thing is that the lottery ticket that you have in your degree is going to impact your life regardless of what happens, right? The draft, it's wonderful. It's beautiful. We've had a lot of guys drafted, and it's a super exciting moment. But you've already won the lottery. You got a degree from Indiana University. You've won the lottery. It's going to impact not just your life, but your kids' lives, your grandkids' lives. Everyone around you is going to be impacted in such a tremendously positive way because you have a degree from a world-class institution. Now, the part about playing baseball on the field is a totally different animal, where it's like you're not going to be able to control the outcome of the situation. If we can just focus entirely on the process of what you're doing, the work you're putting in, and competing the best of your abilities, the rest takes care of itself. So you put those three things together in the blender, and you're able to have a little bit of perspective. You're able to focus on things you can control. And at the end of the day, you end up, in my opinion, with a really nice product, which is a player that doesn't feel like he's carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders every day. You know, he's not trying to completely change the course of his family's life, or he's not going to be considered a failure if he doesn't play incredibly well. He's not. He's far more than a baseball player. And he's going to be able to do the things that he wants to do with the rest of his life from a fulfillment and enjoyment standpoint because of a degree. Now, if he ends up being a really high draft pick and he ends up playing Major League Baseball, what great, I mean, what icing on the cake, what a terrific achievement. But that doesn't define his entire life. And I think those are really important points. and ones that we talk about with the players often. I want them to do it, and I want them to succeed, want them to achieve it, but we also want them to keep in perspective how beautiful life is in all facets, not just in that one.
And Coach, now that we've seen the official confirmation that we'll be having four game weekends, are you ready to talk about how you'll deploy the starting pitching through these weekends?
Yeah, I think we've got, four or five guys with some fringe guys that are still in there. We've got two more weeks here. Kind of make a decision. You look at Tommy Summer and McCabe Brown, Gabe Bierman, Ty Bothwell, John McDuniel's in that conversation. Nate Stahl's been in that conversation. So those five or six guys are, I think, in that conversation for who could get the ball first on the weekends there. And then, you know, as you go through the four-game slates and the three decisions based on who's able to go out and perform the best. But I've been happy with those five or six guys, and I think they've done a good job and have earned consideration for it. And at the same time, when you do have a talented pitching staff, like I do believe that we have, you also are able to take into account some of the matchup stuff as well. Right? If there's a situation where you can't, that could impact things and change things. It doesn't necessarily mean I don't think the guys are starting caliber or if he's good enough. What it means is I think the matchup is better in this situation for this guy or that.
So, Coach, now that we have the schedule out, it looks like 2021, all the regular season games are going to be conference, which is not typical. Usually you have a lot of non-conference stuff to get warmed up. So does this change the way your staff approaches the early season matchups or maybe how you would coach some games or situations?
I don't think it'll change the way that we coach the games. I think that the game will materialize the way that it normally does. It has changed a little bit the way that we prepare the team. I've been really firm with them. I think as much as anything, because we did lose the season last year. So it's a little bit of, hey, we're gonna have to go, and all these games count, and they count towards a conference standing, and we're gonna have to ready to go out and compete at a high level really quickly. And as you mentioned, the four game set. If you struggle on Friday as an offensive player, you're gonna have to be able to toughen up to bounce back and go and play well. But losing the season last year with a younger club, you bank on, hey, we're gonna have experiences through this. We're gonna win some. We're gonna lose some. We're gonna scratch our head and say, how did we do that, good or bad? But you grow through that. Well, for a lot of these guys, they didn't have that, and they had a limited summer ball experience. So I've been really firm this fall and into this early season, all the coaches have, because you're trying to get through them. I know it seems like this is a minor detail, whatever it is that we're doing, but I promise you it's going to be really impactful when the game starts. If you don't know the signs with a runner on second and across the catcher up and the ball goes to the backstop, that you don't have a chance to then, well, I know it now, I'll just redo it. It's like, no, the guy's on third base. Like it's over, the moment's over. Or if it's first and third, and you don't know the first and third play, you don't get to say, hey, my bad, I'll just redo it. The guy just scores, and so you lose that from playing, when not playing, I'm sorry. And so this year, we try to be really firm and understanding that this is going to impact the game. But the conference only, you got to hustle now, right? There's a sense of urgency from the first pitch. Kind of talked about it being a marathon, as all seasons are. You want to be the best thing that you can in the last month. It's a marathon, but it's also a sprint. And so it's a combination of both at the same time. You're kind of running two congruent races at the same time. And do the best you can with it.
Who from your staff will be coaching at first and third base this season?
Dan Hell will be at third, and then Derek Simmons will be at first. I'll be back in the dugout. Derek and I will communicate a lot about the offense for us really runs through the first base coach, and or through me through the first base coach. And me having the chance last year to coach first base really even changed my mindset even more than I had in the past, just seeing the game from a different perspective over there and running the offense in that position, which I really enjoyed. Yeah, but I trust Derek to be there and for us to be able to operate through me to him, to the base runners. And at the same time, I felt important if at all possible for me to be in the dugout. You know, I do work closely with the offensive players, but you know, the pitching decisions, the pitchers in the dugout, the bullpen, all those different moving pieces, it's really hard to obviously manage that from first base. And then from a scouting report standpoint, being in the dugout, I think really helps me to prepare guys for as they go up to their bats. And so we just have to be excellent in all of those different areas to be able to communicate to the players, to help them to be ready for those moments. But also to keep in mind that it's also my responsibility to communicate with Justin and the pitchers and to make sure that those guys have clear direction, you know, as the moments are upon us.
And you talked a little bit before about fundamentals, you know, missing a sign or missing a base. Now, defensively, you've always been big on, you know, hitting the right cutoff man, throwing to the right base. Who'd you say, you know, as far as like some of your biggest defensive IQ guys on the team right now?
I think Cole Barr is a guy that is a cornerstone guy for us. He's really improved defensively from when we got here sophomore year, but even from last year, I think he's a much better defender. He's really blossomed as a communicator too. I really encourage him to lead. He's just worked so hard, and when you work really hard, you earn the right to have your opinion heard. And I think he's earned that right. Tom Hopkins is a guy that really communicates well, you know, really intelligent, high IQ guy, great teammate, does a good job. You're gonna like Paul Tate. He's a good player. He's a smart kid. He's a tough kid, and I like Paul. I think Paul's gonna be able to communicate, and as he kind of grows, you know, through the year, I think we'll do a good job with that.
And then Paul's more middle infield. Paul is more middle infield.
Yeah. Paul's a middle infielder. Can play some left side, play some second base, but is a really fine player. And then Grant Richardson in center field is probably. I've been fortunate enough to coach two National Gold Glove winners in the outfield, and he manages the outfield better than any kids that I've been around or coached. He just communicates. He pays attention. His eyes are always on me in the dugout. He's always anticipating. He's in the right spot, and he makes sure that his cohorts are in the right spot, which is a huge deal. You see it in the fall all the time where you'll see somebody else in center in – a ball drops in the gap, and it's like, well, that wasn't his ball. That's not his fault. Well, in reality, it was his fault because he didn't position the outfielder the way that he should have. And ultimately, that's his responsibility. It's the player's responsibility, but at the end of the day, it's the center field responsibility because he's the leader of that group. And Grant is exceptional at that. So you kind of look through the middle of the field, and you see some small players there. We have a lot of small players. But from a defensive standpoint, I like those guys. And I like having a third baseman. If you look at Coach Simmons, always brings this up, and he's so right. But the great teams, if you look at the great teams you've watched or been around, they almost always have a really good third baseman. They almost always do. They just have a guy that can really come down and get a bump. He's a really good player defensively, offensively. He's a catalyst. And we're fortunate to have Cole in that position. And hopefully we end up being a good team.
He's got a pretty good third baseman to learn from if he wants to, too, there with the with the outfit there.
Yeah, I would say having Scott there in his hip pocket is quite the resource. You're exactly right.
Now, Coach, this next question seems pretty timely in a week where almost three-quarters of the continental U.S. was covered in snow. But there was a proposal put out last year for a later start to the D1 season starting next year. What are your thoughts on that proposal, and do you think it's gaining any significant traction?
Well, the Big Ten, we as a coaches group, were the ones that put that forward and Coach Backich really was the driving force as a continuation of what Coach Anderson and Minnesota have done for years. I'm a firm believer in it, and I understand that a lot of folks look at it as just a weather, because of the weather. You want to have a different season because of the weather. In all actuality, it really is a financial proposal. You know, the reduction in expenses of some of the travel for some of the northern teams, as and then an extension of playing games in better weather. You're allowing yourself to open up to obviously fans and marketability in different items, where you make yourself so much more reasonable to attend for a family. Look at Indianapolis Indians, or you look at the professional teams in the world, and you look at these teams. And I would tell people, if we played Michigan at home on an 80-degree weekend and we were both ranked, we were both having a good season, both ranked, you have to build a bigger stadium. You have to build bigger seats, right? You'd sell that place out. And that goes across the country. That's in the SEC. That's in the ACC. You know, we opened at LSU last year. You guys were there. It wasn't warm, right? It wasn't like it was 80 degrees. I mean, the Friday game was 40 degrees, right? By the 35 degrees by the end of the game. So this isn't just a northern thing. This isn't a Big Ten thing, or we're trying to pull an overall in college baseball. This is looking at the health of the game. This is looking at better TV slots. You know, we're not competing with March Madness, not competing with the basketball tournament. You're getting into a window where it's baseball season. Where people, they turn their attention to baseball because you're in the spring and in the summer when, you know, Major League Baseball is something more important. There's a ton of opportunities there for financial growth, and I believe this firmly. If I was a coach in any conferences, to continue to grow the game, we have to look at it as the marketability as a sport and the financial feasibility across the board. We have to be able to be more of a net zero, right? Not necessarily a detractor financially, but a net zero or potentially a gain. Conferences or different programs. I think the proposal allows us to do that.
So, Coach, what has been the toughest thing for you adapting to coaching throughout the COVID time?
I think the toughest part was not being able to spend the one-on-one time communicating with the players. Where you can do a Zoom call, you can do those things, but so much of coaching and teaching is in small groups, is in large groups, is in the locker room conversations, is where you're hands on in those areas, and when you're up and you're down, you're shut down, you're back together. Those things are really difficult. You know, you're looking at trying to get guys ready to play as fast as you can without rushing guys, and then so you lose a lot of the time to have the cause and effect conversation, where you go scrimmage, you go practice, you go play, whatever it is, and then you sit down there directly after and say, okay, here was the cause, here's the effect, here's the outcome, here's the adjustment, and you lose a lot of those things. And you try to make up for it as best you can without putting players at risk physically to accelerate their timeline. But there's just it's just difficult to communicate, difficult to coach in some of those different areas. And we've been pretty fortunate. And I feel like we're in a pretty good place. But it is hard. It's not without its challenges. But everyone has them. And we have to find a solution for them. That's where I feel like our technology really does help to be able to communicate and to be able to get information directly from practice onto their systems, onto their platforms, viewable, coachable. And if that means I have to do a Zoom call with them to go over it, or if they have to call me, or if we have to meet in an unfamiliar way, that's fine. But we do have to find a way to continue to coach. That's probably been the hardest part.
Who have you learned the most from in your coaching career?
I was really, really fortunate that my dad coached and was and is a terrific coach, a very, very high-level coach. Coached obviously at Indiana, but also was offered SEC coaching jobs when I was growing up in the States because my brothers and I had to take him. I've learned the most from him throughout the course of as a player to a young coach to now a more established coach. We would go home and on the drive home, we were talking about like practice plans. And he's talking at a level that really allowed me to look at the game in a different way than probably 16 or 17 year olds. But the biggest thing was management, the responsibility that comes with being a head coach. There is a responsibility with being a coach in general, but there is a responsibility that comes from when I say in charge. I don't mean like that because our entire staff works so closely together. But at the end of the day, I have a responsibility to give the best of myself every day to all of the coaches, to all of the players, to the support staff. There is a responsibility there that can't be lost. I think sometimes coaches feel like the responsibility is for others to serve the head coach. And that's just not the case. Your responsibility is to everyone else. And him being in those chairs and being able to communicate those things to me, and to this day, I talk to him 4 or 5 days a week. We were texting today about different things, run ideas passing, hey, what do you think about this and that? And then my college coach, Rob Cooper, who's now the head coach at Penn State, was a tremendous personal influence on me, made me a far better coach having played for Coop than had I not. Just the understanding that baseball, the X's and O's are really important. He's a good X's and O's guy. And so am I. That's fine. But the personal side of things, how to manage young people in the best way possible, was something that I took from him. The conversations that Coach Cooper and I had were very seldomly about do this with your hands or do this with your glove. It was much more about like, what do we value? Where do we place value? How do we look at ourselves? How do we view failure and success? And that really was a huge deal for me. I know it's probably shocking, but I was a pretty high-strung kid. I know you just like can't believe that I would be a high-strung, like a little bit volatile young person, but I was, and it really helped me to manage that. So I would say those two people, and so to this day, I talk to Coach Cooper all the time, and I was talking to my dad almost daily. But I was really fortunate. I had a lot of really good coaches, a lot of really good people that were there to smack me in the back of the head when I did silly stuff and say, knucklehead, don't do that. That's not the right way to go about your business. And I still make mistakes, but I do try to be self-aware.
What advice would you give to someone looking to get into coaching as a career?
Think twice about it. I'll feel really strongly about it. As you get into coaching, like your responsibility, it is not about you as a coach, right? It's you have a responsibility to the people around you to be the best that you can be every day. The players deserve to be coached every day. They deserve to have the best of you. Now, there's going to come a point in time when a player says, I really want coach, or I really don't. And I understand there comes a point in time where a guy says, I don't want to be coached. But every day you wake up, you have a responsibility to give the absolute best of yourself to those kids. And if you're not willing to invest and to educate and to provide that experience, then this is a really difficult profession because it's 24 hours a day. It's baseball, but it's life. It's finances. It's everything. It's a much more than just like, you know, when I first started coaching, I thought, well, I'll be a really good hitting coach and everything will go fine. And I realized I do hitting like 5% of the time and you do everything else 95% of it. So if you're not, this isn't to be derogatory. It's just, I don't think sometimes people understand that the impact and the pull that it requires to provide the experience that the kids deserve to have. And that's all of you. And that's the best of you. I would also say that young people, right, we're not, and I'm still a young person, but young people, they want discipline. Discipline is good. Discipline in a structured, organized way. I think discipline says, I care. I care enough about you to hold you to the highest standard that you're capable of being held to. And less than that is a failure on what you could do. And that means that I don't care. If I don't care enough to hold you to a really high standard. But it has to be organized. You can't just holler and yell because someone didn't get a hit or someone didn't throw a strike. That's not productive. But if we have willful disobedience, if we have willful disobedience of the process that we've agreed is going to lead to success, then there needs to be an accountability and discipline within that. And to me, that says, I care about you enough to be involved. I think sometimes as young coaches, it's like, well, I want to be, you know, Mr. Tuffy, and I'm not organized, and I end up being just a jerk, right? And I'm just a jerk. because I'm not organized and I don't know what I'm yelling about, but I just know I'm supposed to yell. Or I become everybody's best friend, which they have all kinds of friends. And there's nothing wrong with being a nice guy. I'm a nice guy. But they don't always just need you to tell them how wonderful everything was, because sometimes it's not. And so the truth matters. So I think those would be the two things that I would say as a young coach. Just be aware of what you're getting yourself into. It's a beautiful life. Like, I have a beautiful life. I have an incredible life every day. It's an incredible experience. But it is, it's a full-time deal, and you have to go into understanding that.
Thanks, Coach, for answering that way. I really think when we look at these baseball coaches, we're thinking about, you know, does he bunt? Does he hit and run? And to just hear how much is under the umbrella of what you have to do to lead these young men, it's impressive.
Well, I appreciate that, and that's all of us, right? All of us in the program, and there's so many good coaches around the country. And you know, when we sit down as a staff, and I'm asking these guys every day, like, you know, hold me accountable. Like, tell me, you know, how do I do my job? And you know, I'm going to do the same thing to you. But what happens is when we do have, when we're able to provide that fully encompassing experience where you do have discipline all the way around, and you are valued so much more than as a baseball player. When you have that, then bunting becomes easier, right? Then if I'm not carrying the weight of a personal relationship, that's out having a tough, difficult time, of the draft, of academics, of a family situation, if I'm not carrying that load by myself, it's much easier for me to go in and enjoy the moment of the game and to be able to be fully committed and focused to be able to put a bunt on or to execute a first and third play or to execute. Oftentimes, if we just do what we should do in the course of the game, then a coach doesn't need to trick the game to produce a run. You know, we just had double in the gap. We score a run because we walked and doubled. But when we manage the whole picture, the things that we would like to see on the field normally end up coming out better. But I do really appreciate that, Chris.
And our guys, obviously, through the years, we've been around a little while. We've had Coach Smith, Coach Lemonis. Now you've come on board. You guys are picking up trophies the first year. So we've been very lucky with who's been brought into the baseball program. But we've had to watch the young guys adapt to changes. And now we see you with the change of athletic director. How's that been for you and your staff?
Wonderful. You know, really fortunate to have Fred Glass when we had him. I have a great relationship and a great friendship. He was incredible. But Scott Wilson was part of the group and part of the hiring process for me. And so I had a really good relationship with Scott from the beginning. He was sat in the room as I was being interviewed initially. And through the next several years, we were able to build a great friendship. Just, you know, always seeing each other and around. And he's a huge baseball supporter. He was down at the Louisville Regional 2 years ago. I saw him up there hollering and yelling, and he was yelling at a ball or strike call. I know that because I stood up to yell, and as I sat back down, I saw him yelling. So that's how I knew he was
probably nice.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. I'm so fortunate to get to have him as a leader, as we all are, and as a boss. I'm just like absolutely ecstatic about what he brings at Indiana and what he's going to provide in the future. I've just been super impressed so far. Not that he needs my opinion, not that it matters at all, but I've just been able to sit back and watch, and I'm like, this guy loves Indiana. He's got such a great vision. I'm just thrilled. I really am. You know, just for example, we're doing a virtual official visit for our 2021 class this coming weekend. And so, I sent him a text message and asked about a video, if he would like to do a video to welcome the class. And we were just trying to talk back and forth. He's always offering that. He texted me back like 1 minute later. He's like, I would be ecstatic. Thank you so much for asking me. I've heard so many wonderful things about the 2021 class. Can't wait to do it. Da, 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 da. And he gets me a video over like four hours late, whatever it is. He was right back on top of it. Just really passionate and really looking forward to it. It's going great.
It came at a good time. That class might be the best highly ranked we've had so far.
Yeah, it's a really special one. talk about excited. I'm excited. I'm excited about the season. I'm excited about the team this year and the boys. And but that group's a really special group as well.
So we know a lot of your time is taken up with baseball activities. What kind of things do you like to do to unwind and recharge when you get some off time?
That is a question on my house. I'm an avid outdoorsman. I love to be outside. I love to hunt and fish and work. We have about 40 acres and horses and chickens, and so I love to be outside working on the property or with my family outside doing something. I'm the oldest of four boys, and I have a 2.5-year-old. My parents live next door to us, so we're usually outside doing something. My dad has gotten into woodworking quite a bit, so I spent a lot of my time in the last year or two helping, just kind of as an overseer of his projects, right? He's had a lot of fun with that, and it's been a lot of fun watching him enjoy those things and with my mom as well. So, anything I can do to be outside in enjoying nature is something that I consider to be a great day.
What about, I know something we always ask the players, as far as like growing up, favorite baseball team, players that you watch a lot. I mean, you grew up in Indiana, right? So you didn't have a team, but who did you follow? Who were you a fan of?
My dad grew up a Red Sox fan, so I always kind of followed the Red Sox. And my grandfather grew up, was a big Cubs fan. The one my dad's dad grew up in, it was in Indianapolis, so I followed the Cubs quite a bit. And then my mom's side of the family is down from near Cincinnati on the Indiana side. And so they were always big Reds fans. And so it kind of depended upon, where we were at the time. I kind of followed. And as my dad was able to work with different players, some of the different guys would play on a big league team. And so then I would end up kind of following that team. And then when my dad and obviously Scott Wilmer have a long relationship, My dad and Dusty Baker are really good friends. So when Dusty and Scott were both with the Reds, that was a pretty fun time, following those guys. But a little bit of everything. A little bit of everything. As far as players, I mean, Scott was my favorite player. But I can remember when we were like baseball historians a little bit. My dad was kind of an aficionado, and my dad's friends were old time coaches. And so I don't know how it got started, but Satchel Paige was like I would just write book reports, and he was like my favorite player because I love like the mystique and the stories and all the funny stories. And he's pitching from second base and doubleheader, shutout, and all these different things. And so I was infatuated with him for a long, long time. And those were always my book reports. So when someone would ask me who my favorite player was, I would say Satchel Paige, and they're like, "Who?" And I'm like, "It's from a long time ago." But I was always loved funk, and those were stories that my dad and his friend Tim McCarney and Mark Beeper and all these guys were always talking about. And then when Scott, got to big leagues and followed him really closely, now we get to work together every day, which is still surreal, right? It's still rather incredible. So, that's a great question. I kind of eclectic, a little bit all over the board, but just a lot of baseball, and then the Indianapolis Colts. So once Peyton Manning came to the Colts, we both been for 25, 30 years. That was what we did.
Well, that will do it for this edition of Talking Hoosier Baseball. We want to extend our thanks to Coach Mercer on joining us this evening. You can read up on Indiana baseball at iubase.com. Follow us on Twitter at @CUatTheBart and at @iubase17. On Instagram, it's iubase. And you can also subscribe to the Talking Hoosier Baseball channel on YouTube, which features these video podcasts, summer league game clips, game day media availabilities, and much more. For Carl James, Chris Feeney, Josh Bennett, and Jeff Mercer, I'm Cassidy Palmer. See you at the BART.